saving money on everything you need at Menards. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money
at Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers.
I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/new.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Helen Lewis and I'm filling in for Andrew Hunter-Murray, who has this week sadly failed develop vetting. I'm in the Private Eye studio with Adam McQueen, Ian Hislop and Saba Salman, editor of Rotten Boroughs. The local elections are coming up and it's going to be a splintering, I guess, of Britain as people vote against Labour and the Tories where they're still standing. What does the picture look like?
Well, let me paint you a little picture of Sunderland. Come with me as I take you to one of the big reform rallies.
Because that is where Nigel Farage of Reform launched his campaign. So he must be pretty confident of winning it, or that would be quite embarrassing.
Absolutely. So I'll just take you to Sunderland with me now. So if you picture a scene, 2,000 strong stadium room, big lights, music to announce all of the speakers, and a tune that you may not know. It's called Street Rev Anthem by an electronica pop producer.
Why has Nigel Farage got better taste in music than me? That feels yeah. Wrong. Actually, Nigel, I was going to say, coming into Right Said Fred, but unfortunately that's my brain has supplied that, because Nigel Farage does often sing along to I'm Too Sexy by Right Said Fred.
That's right, but you know, small mercies, no Andrew Jenkins singing her own tune, so at least that's something. So in Sunderland, he's basically banging on about the same thing, which is low tax, community voices, which is kind of what local councillors do anyway, so not a difficult promise to make.
And they don't set the tax.
Council tax is set at a local level with guidance by government. But I think what's interesting with the reform promises on this, as we've said in Rotten Boroughs, is that a lot of the reform councillors have come in and said, we're not going to raise taxes, we're going to actually cut taxes. And what's happened is they have raised them, but the way it's being peddled is, we've got the lowest raises in the country, therefore we're sort of sticking to our manifesto. So it's a cheeky way of retaining that popularity. However, over in Worcestershire, which we've again covered in the boroughs, they've raised their council tax there by 9%. Wow. So there's again that same thing, the gap between what's being promised and what's actually being delivered.
And I've seen Farage kind of desperately backpedalling on that and saying, absolutely not, I never said taxes would go down.
Yes.
At and which I hate point to you play in lots of clips of lots of other people.
Absolutely.
From reform saying
so,
that they
so
would
I
definitely
think,
go down when we're in
charge. Hate to be fair to Nigel Farage, but the fact is that, you know, he hasn't actually gone on their record to say, I am not going to be raising local council tax.
Right.
There's a general kind of implication that taxes will be lower across the board. And if you're lucky enough to have one of the reform leaflets plop onto your doorstep, as I had recently, that's one of the sort of the five commitments.
Although I did notice, if you read the Sunday Times profile of the 19-year-old reform council leader, he did manage to fight off everyone else to have a lower rate of council tax. I want to ask you, can you remember what it is that he keeps in his office?
He keeps a bear in his office.
An actual bear?
No,
like
sorry.
Lord Byron?
No. He keeps a stuffed bear. I believe it's on loan from the local museum.
Is this George Finch?
George Finch.
This
so George Finch
isn't it?
Is in Warwickshire.
I really should clarify on the bear. I thought teddy bear. Then I saw the photo.
No,
it's about 5 foot tall. It's a taxidermied bear.
Because the symbol of Warwickshire is a bear, isn't it?
Yeah, bear and ragged stuff.
Yeah.
Yes, but more importantly, bears are big and buff and scary. Butch. And I think, you know, for a 19-year-old, nothing against young 19-year-olds, but that's the image that he wants to portray.
It's one of the least convincing things I've heard.
We're recording this in the centre of Soho. I can recommend a couple of pubs if he wants to go on and meet some very big rugged bears.
Pass that on next time.
They're very fond of 19-year-olds, actually, quite a lot of them.
let's move.
We're indifferent to you, Anne.
For the point in Sunderland, just to end on Sunderland, all of the 75 seats are up for election. And obviously Reform is making that one of their big targets.
Is this what we're meant to be looking for? Is that Reform isn't just home counties, it's not seaside towns, it can make it in the big post-industrial north.
Yes, exactly that. So I think that one interesting thing is that the amount of candidates, Helen, you mentioned that the thousands of people that are standing, Reform is fielding candidates in about 95% of seats. And I went on to the Reform website just for research purposes to see what it would take to stand as a candidate. And, you know, obviously the nominations have closed now. But before that, it was very clear they were very, very, very keen for as many candidates, many people as possible to stand. And clearly said, you know, no experience necessary, which, given the state of local government now, bankruptcies, pressure on services, you really want somebody in there who knows what they're doing.
In Scotland, Reform have had 5 MSP candidates have to withdraw from the ballot. Would you like to guess any of the things that they've done? What are the kind of things you think a Reform candidate might do that mean that they have to withdraw?
Is it social media posting?
Funny you should say that. Linda Holt called Humza Yousaf, former SNP leader, an Islamist moron, and many things in that case. Her partner stood down in solidarity with her, which is very, very That's moving. Nice. Any more ideas about why you might have to stand down as a Reform candidate?
Anything to do with Bitcoin?
Not as yet. There's 2 of them who said that they didn't intend to stand and it was an error.
That's quite... We've stood for Parliament by accident.
We've gone on holiday by mistake. And then the final one was a classic, an old classic, a bit like Bitcoin, allegations of financial misconduct linked to a COVID bounce back loan.
Right, it's a classic. The old
classics. But yeah, whereas the Greens have had similar troubles, they've had 2 different people had to withdraw for saying that, first saying that the gold is green ambulance arson was a false flag, and then one upgraded it saying that the October 7th attacks there on Israel, they were also false flag. Both those had to pull out. So I think that speaks to the fact that, I mean, you've been covering this about Reform, you know, yep. They've got in a lot of warm bodies, but not all of them competent warm bodies.
Well, also dead bodies. We've had a Reform candidate, mayoral candidate last year who'd actually been dead for 6 months. So, I mean, you know...
Don't be so alivist.
But there has been this tradition of people who are sort of paper candidates,
yes.
Who are put forward so that you can show. I mean, presumably this is the aim with this, is that Nigel Farage can say, we've got this enormous slate of candidates, look at, you know... It's
absolutely,
sort of
and Liz Truss's husband was one of those paper candidates.
For Reform?
For the Conservatives.
Right, OK, I was going to say we have a scoop there.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Okay.
No. I think we
they're still Conservatives,
that.
Aren't they?
At the moment, yes. Although she has kind of...
Yeah, she's so spiritually reformed these days. I can only assume that Nigel Farage going, no, get away from me. Yeah, you can't come anywhere
near
me.
But that is quite a risk, isn't it? Because in the last set of local elections, I remember there were several people who were put up effectively as paper candidates for Reform, did get in, and then regretted it and dropped out immediately afterwards.
And that is exactly what's happened with Reform, with the 10 councils that the Reform won last year, 677 councillors, and a lot of them did not expect to actually have to do the job, and they got there and been shocked and have been quite crap. But to go back to the...
Is that a technical term?
It's high...
It sounds like some sort of...
jargon, yes.
Yeah, council like responsibility and protection, is it?
I mean, you know, there are certain things that you need to do as a councillor, and, you know, for example, not breaking the code of conduct is one of them. Turn up is another one. Maybe don't, you know, be offensive, racist, misogynistic might be another. But to go back to the green thing, what's interesting in terms of vetting is we've had these problems with Reform because of the surge of the number of candidates. And there's a similar thing going on with the Greens, which, again, we've talked about in Rotten Boroughs, where I think there's been about 50 defections, I think all from Labour to the Greens across the country. Zach Polanski has said, almost like, don't blame me because we've got all these people coming, so we can't possibly keep tabs on all of them. That's massively paraphrasing, by the way, in case anyone picks me up on that. But, you know,
probably
recently,
him. He's quite assertive in his counter-attack. I think it's part of the PR drive. But the problem with the green candidates they're putting up is not that they're too green or they're extremistly green. It's that they don't seem to have expressed much interest in the environment over the years, and they're mostly interested in different types of politics. Tower Hamlets, the Lufter mob, they weren't known for their aggressive environmental stance, were they?
No.
That wasn't the big thing for them.
I believe that when the many stories that we've run in the Eye were not really about their green credentials.
No.
At all. But, I mean, these are people who are desperate for power. I don't want to use the word hypnotic, magnetism or Polanski, but there's something there, isn't there? We had a story recently in Rotten Boroughs where there was a former Tower Hamlets Labour councillor, also a loyalist for Lutfi Rahman, the current Aspire
friend of
leader,
the Eye,
favourite of the Eye, and he was booted out because he was supporting the independents. He's recently resurfaced while campaigning on behalf of the independents down in Tower Hamlets. He scooted up to Barking and Dagenham to support one of the new Green councillors who used to be Labour, who defected to the Greens. Are you with me? Are you following?
Yes, defected no, very much.
Defected to the Greens because apparently of the Labour stance on Gaza. However, he didn't say anything about the Labour stance on Gaza before he defected and, in fact, was deselected. So he's up there campaigning.
Does he also have a record?
This is the character who was done for housing fraud.
Yes, I'm just mentioning it.
In terms of
elected to local government.
No, exactly. But, I mean, going back to the vetting thing, it's that thing of him standing there with Zach Polanski brandishing a bright green vote green.
I think some people just like to be near something that seems exciting and new, and they're like, and that is Zach Polanski for
they
people.
They do, and they like to photograph it, and they like to put it on social media, and then it's spotted.
I just think, I mean, with the vetting thing, I was thinking this with all the Mandelson stuff in the last week, just develop vetting. Should we just throw open the Private Eye archive to these people? That's all you really need, isn't it?
Free sub, yeah.
Well, actually, in the case of Lord Mandelson, of course, what you need is someone to just go, no, it's Peter Mandelson, which would have solved an awful lot of problems.
But, yeah,
anyway,
that Peter
back
Mandelson.
Back to local politics.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing you feel that, on one level, councils have not got a great deal of control over lots of stuff, right? Most of them are burdened by adult social care, and that's where the majority of their budget goes, and there's really that limits their actions. However, if it's stuff like getting your mate up the housing waiting list, then actually there are things as a councillor you can do, right? The temptations that councillors feel are often in the sort of nepotism-y kind of variety, aren't they?
Absolutely, nepotism, backhanders, and that's the stuff of Rotten Boroughs, really. But yes, many examples where people have, you know, been very kind to their chums and helped them with, you know, planning or housing.
Well, we now criticised Reform and the Greens, so let's talk about a really crap Labour council and Birmingham. I don't think that's not unfair, is it? That's
not, you know, at all. Not at
the
all.
The bins, the bankruptcy.
That's right.
Something else beginning with B.
But, yeah, one of Britain's most bankrupt councils. It's the largest in Europe, and all the 101 seats are up for election. This is another one that's likely to go into no overall control, which, you know, we are seeing increasing numbers of this. And when
is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well,
I mean, overall control hasn't been great in Birmingham, has it?
No. You would think it would be a positive thing because you then have more local debate, you don't have a party political stance. But certainly in all the years that I've been covering local government, I've noticed that, you know, the no overall control thing used to be far more rare because we just had the 2-3 main parties. And now that's being fractured. We are getting councils that are hung, councils that are minority administration, which, you know, may be led nominally by Labour or Lib Dem, but really it's by a few seats. And that makes it really difficult for decisions to get through, for budgets to be set. Everything just becomes harder to find agreement on. So technically it should be better because you're not following the party line, that's not an agenda. But the nuts and bolts of getting things done essentially is harder, and it's
increasingly
instability.
Presumably getting more difficult because sort of political views are splintering more, people are going more to two extremes. I mean, potentially we're going to end up with hung councils that are half Reform and half Green, aren't we? Which is quite hard to see. And the Conservatives and the Lib Dems always worked very, very well together at a level in local government, which I think is why the Lib Dems in 2010 thought, oh, we could do this in national government, it will go really, really well. Didn't work out for them, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But it's going to be very, very difficult when people are that politically opposed.
Exactly. And Birmingham, to take that example, I mean, I think there's about 45 councils due to exchange hands in the next elections, May 7th. But to go back to Birmingham, that's an interesting one. So Kemi Badenoch went down to Birmingham and made it known that she would not oppose a Conservative Reform coalition locally, not nationally. And Unite the Union, which is obviously involved in the bin strikes. So for the last year, we've had the strikes over refuse workers. Unite the Union has had secret talks with Reform
Blimey.
Yeah. So it's all kicking off.
Is it possible to resolve that dispute by anyone? I'm just asking because
I can't see how. The whole backdrop of the row over the bin workers, there's an equal pay row as well, so some sort of 700 odd million. The council declared effective bankruptcy back in 2023. It's been helped by government, so it's got this exceptional financial support so it can borrow. It's an absolute dire strait. So that's an example of where I don't know what the solution is to any of those things apart from borrowing more money from government.
Right. You can tell me if you were canvassed. I live in Lewisham. We were canvassed by some very nice Greens who were former Labour people. And one of the things they said is we want to end austerity. And I was like, sounds good, but with what money? Mm. Like, I don't think the Lewisham Council is secretly sitting on a like smorgs pot of gold that they've just been cruelly refusing to disburse up until now.
30 odd councils now have had this handout from government.
But a number of our letter writers make this point. But
yes.
A handout from the government to local council is not a handout. It's taxpayers' money being spent in different ways. So if central government underfunds councils, which is a criticism, then councils borrow from them. They're not exactly begging, are they? They're trying to find a restitution of some balance.
Yes.
Between the two types of taxpayers.
That's right. And while all that's going on, the pressure to provide those adult social care services and support and how all of that's still continuing. So really, it's a pretty difficult picture out there.
It was a big narrative, I remember, from the last lot of local elections, which was all, we're going to come in and we're going to cut waste and we're going to cut DEI initiatives and all that kind of thing. And the experience, once people got into power, seemed to be that actually, well, you can do a bit of that, but the sort of sums of money are fractional. Not to say that there isn't waste in local government. Of course there is. You write about it constantly in your column. But they're fractional compared with the actual, the adult social care budget and all those kind of big things. Has that sort of gone away as a narrative now, or are people still pushing there is some money down the back of the sofa?
I think certain reform councils are still peddling that myth of massive inefficiency.
Well, we'll take down the progress flag over the town hall and that's £100 million.
You know, you have a statutory duty to look after people in your area who need support, and that costs money.
Mm.
People are living longer, people need social care, that is your responsibility. Taking down the flag, it's not going to bring the sums that you think it's going to bring. And so therefore you have to raise council tax.
And a lot of the problems that your column exposes are councils think, we haven't got any money, here's an idea, usually involving outsourcing something or investing in some traditionally council activity, that we go in with the private sector and it all goes wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah, going with the private sector, whether that's through housing or schools. Housing is another one that we've covered a huge amount, where a lot of councils are were launching their own housing companies or regeneration companies and playing at being private sector players. And it's gone absolutely tits up.
And they claim this is desperation, that they have to do this. I mean, obviously, we're not buying that because we write about it. But that's pressure from having no other sources of income, presumably.
Yes, that's
right. Apart from raising the council tax.
It is. And it's. I think, what people often forget, successive governments have cut back on these main areas that councils have to. So while the responsibility is still there, the supply of the cash that's going to help them meet that responsibility is year on year shrinking. I think one thing, actually, in some of these cases with the housing companies and the regeneration companies that are launched, I think it's not just about money. I think we've proved it's also about the glitz and the glamour of rubbing shoulders with the big developers and, going to conferences abroad that are...
That said, one of my biggest groans during this campaigning season was Ed Davey, leader of the Lib Dems, saying that he wants to impose a duty on every new housing development to have a GP surgery. And he was just like, yes, what we should do is just put one more restriction on house building. That's the
two
charm,
things we haven't got enough of, let's put them together.
Isn't there a bit of a problem as well in the health sector with GPs supply and hours and
Also, one of the things is that every new development is often subject to like judicial review and then planning appeals. So if you're building that GP, if you're a GP, do you want to move into somewhere that in 3 years' time there might be some houses there, or depending whether or not the residents have taken it all the way to the High Court. No, in fact, there won't be. Or they found a newt or something like that.
Yes. The residents' blood pressure will have gone up so much that you will have quite a few kind of patients coming in as a result of that.
It's true. On the no overall control thing, so there are currently 32 councils outside London that are no overall control. Sam Freeman, in a very good Substack about the local elections, said he thinks there's probably going to be another 32 outside London at the end of this. So that's really the story of these elections, isn't it? It's like we hate the mainstream. If you've still got a Tory council, you're going to register that you hate them. But mostly if you've got a Labour council, you're going to register that you hate them.
Mm. That fracture is really interesting. You know, on one hand, you've got Labour and Tory local candidates distancing themselves. But over here, you've got Reform and the Greens bigging up the cult of personality with Polanski and Farage. So it's really interesting. And over in Durham, we talked about Durham earlier, they've got a life-size cardboard cutout of Nigel Farage in their Reform meeting room, which they cart off to the main council chamber. So I think they must have been really excited when they had the rally in Sunderland because they had the real guy there.
That's tragic, because like Donald Trump is hoping for gold statues, and Britain being Britain,
cost of living crisis touches even Reform.
What slightly retro fact became obvious at the Scottish Party leaders' televised debate?
It was on the wireless.
They sent a pigeon individually to each Scottish voter's home with the results of who'd won. Tragically not, although that would be charming. They're all men. It's been a big turnabout in Scottish politics from halcyon days of Kezia Dugdale, Ruth Davidson, Nicola Sturgeon having three main parties. Yeah. It's all chaps. The chapocracy has returned to Scotland. Joanna Cherry, former SNP MP, has left the SNP in fairly spectacular fashion with a book coming out, Keeping the Dream Alive, which details her fallout with Nicola Sturgeon and the party. Mm. What did she claim that the SNP wanted to melt down in 2018?
Was it their gold reserves?
It was a bust of Alex Salmond. Yeah, she says that the party was only too keen to move on from the Alex Salmond era
it wasn't a gold bust of Alex Salmond. I'm still thinking about Trump's
statues. I don't think the SNP have got that much money. Right, okay. Some sort of Barnett formula redistribution.
They did really like him for quite a long time, didn't they? Yes. Before they decided they didn't. They do have an amazing ability to fall out with each other horribly at the top of the SNP, don't they?
But are they going to get in again?
They'll be the largest party, I think, on the predictions. Yes, as previously discussed, Reform have had a bit of a mare. Their leader made a very unpleasant homophobic joke about George Michael at like a rugby club dinner.
Mm.
Too strong even for the rugby club dinner, apparently. Right. There were gasps in the room, which
and
is
I've
really
got
saying something.
Quite a high tolerance for these things, and I read it and I went, I don't think so. So they've had the many candidates withdraw, their press officer has stepped down, so they are still in the slightly like the basket case organisational stage that's gonna count against them. So yeah, even though the SNP have been in government for an incredibly long time, luckily fresh-faced John Swinney,
yes,
the current and former First Minister, what does he want to do to chickens?
Reduce their cost.
How does he plan to
give them the vote in a referendum?
16-year-olds and chickens.
That's the way to get it above 60%, isn't it?
But how does he want to make them cheaper specifically?
He wants a price cap on various sort of basics across all supermarkets, doesn't he?
He does. He wants a series of like, essential items to be capped in price.
Milk, eggs, cheese, I saw. The problem with that one, surely, is that who does the cost get passed on to? Because, I mean, already you've got dairy farmers and egg farmers in pretty perilous position because they've been beaten down by the supermarkets.
Yeah.
You've got a very, very big farming constituency in Scotland. I would say that's causing you problems.
Yeah.
I was in Stranraer the other week outside the Caledonian Cheese Company, makers of seriously strong cheddar.
You know, how strong?
It's seriously strong. No, it's just every supermarket you go to in Britain. And bizarrely, in Scotland, they dye it orange for no apparent reason.
Wow.
And if you ask them, why do you dye your cheddar orange? No one knows. It's just a bizarre
Scottish tradition. Cheddar.
But
what about the impact on smaller shops then? Because that's supermarkets, isn't it?
It's only the big shops.
Yeah.
He says he wants to explain it. I'm just going to be crude here and say, it doesn't make sense. He doesn't have the power to do... He's not a commissar. He doesn't do price controls. It would, in any case, the supermarkets work on very thin margins. You can't have like corner shops now being mandated, so they would be excluded.
Well, they would lose out massively.
You see all the supermarket advertising, which along with betting is the only thing that's propping up print newspapers at the moment. All of their adverts at the moment about Marmite is cheaper than Aldi's. You know, they are all competing right there, so the kind of profits to be made on it are tiny margins anyway.
Definitely.
So.
My local supermarket a couple of years ago was giving away chickens. Dead ones.
Obviously. Oh, that's really becoming much less interesting.
This is part of your theory, Helen, that the voter must be bailed out at all costs. So if there is a cost of living crisis, then food will have to be subsidised. It's sort of everything now, isn't it?
It's sad that we've given up on growth and wage growth, particularly. You know, there's very strong wage compression at the bottom end between minimum wage, which is now about 22,000-23,000, and then there's a huge chunk of the economy that's just all around there, and then very few people in the higher bands. So instead of making it so that people are getting higher wages per hour, let's try and find ways to give them money, which is, you know, things like the energy price cap. It become very popular. But
giving away money as an electoral strategy used to be a bit of a joke, but it isn't.
But it is. Cheap chicken. OK, let's do Wales very quickly. I've got a question for you. Who characterised the Senate elections as a choice between tolerance or division, progress or decay, defiance or deference, culture or ignorance, humanity or indifference?
Was it ChatGPT?
Well, I think you've made a very cruel assertion there about Rinap Yorworth, age of Plaid Cymru. Okay. That's how he framed it. But the reason I mention this is that his final two binaries, it's not X, it's Y, which I grant you is a little ChatGPT, was Plaid Cymru or Reform. That's how he's fighting that election.
Well, there isn't anyone else in Wales anymore.
I mean, that's going to be a really interesting one to watch. And in terms of psychologically for Labour, losing Wales would be a big deal. Elena Morgan, their leader there, has said she would work with Plaid. So they may find a way if they are the first and second largest parties. But it also illustrates something that's been a theme of what we've been talking about, which is there are now two blocks in British politics, and people can circulate between Labour, SNP, Plaid, the Greens, that's the left block, and then the Tories and Reform categorise the right block, and they're cannibalising each other's votes.
Can I just say Restore?
Oh, yes, sorry, just not mentioned.
Restore, yes.
Who are standing? No, they're not standing.
Well, they're not standing any candidates, but what they are doing is backing Great Yarmouth First. So Rupert Lowe, founder of Restore, that's his constituency, and so...
I just love this because America First is all
about... We can't restore
Britain,
we're just going to do it in Great Yarmouth. It's more manageable.
No, this is going to work. Make Yarmouth great.
Great again, exactly. And the last I looked, he had been promising to put up the £5 membership fee for the first 500, I believe it was, members of Great Yarmouth First.
Well, if you need any more Great Yarmouth news, then Sabah's column is the place to check out. I don't know why I've made that commitment on your behalf. Sorry about that. This week would have been the Queen's 100th birthday. And whenever I hear an occasion like that, I think, Adam, is there a quiz to be had?
There may well be. It's, of course, only her unofficial 100th birthday, because the Queen has two birthdays.
Oh.
Two cakes, two lots of presents. She's got the Trooping the Colour, isn't it? On the is it June the 7th, I think.
We don't need to give her
a fake
birthday.
I think Charles has now inherited as now the King's official birthday as well, which is just...
That's weird. You can't inherit a birthday.
Can I just clarify? She isn't actually 100, though, is she? Because she's died.
No, she has been dead for the last few of those years. But nevertheless...
Because I've been reading the papers and there's at least 27 new biographies out, and none of them make it entirely clear.
Well, actually, as we've been on air, it's been revealed that she is still alive.
Ah, good.
And she's here now!
And she's standing for which council?
Up against Paddington.
Aww. No, I think it's interesting, actually, because it's now 4 years since the Queen died, and I have really, really noticed a kind of change in tone of the kind of coverage, which a lot of it has come through. We had the announcement this week that the official biography is going to be written. A historian has been appointed that, a historian who originally wrote, best known for the book she wrote about the interregnum, the time when Cromwell was
Anna
in
Kay.
Charge, which is quite an interesting... Anna Kay, that's the right... Yeah. Which is going to be the really interesting one, because she presumably will get access to all of those papers that otherwise remain locked up in the bowels of Windsor Castle with the Thames Valley Police kind of saying, well, could we have a look at them? Because there's some stuff in there about Prince Andrew. Maybe she'll get access to them first. Be a bit of a race. But also there's a big Robert Hardman, how many royal books has Robert Hardman written by now? But this one apparently is, you know, his new take on the Queen. And there is a bit of a new take going on. Two things I've really, really noticed in royal coverage just in the last few weeks is there suddenly seems to be a moment where the columnists decided that Beatrice and Eugenie were up for being criticised. It's always been a case of, you know, you can say whatever you want about Andrew, whatever you want about Fergie, but the two princesses, you know, they shouldn't be blamed for whatever their parents had done. And there seemed to be literally one week where suddenly Jan Moyer and...
Janice Turner noticed that Eugenie had one of those charities that has lots of big fundraising galas but doesn't seem to actually give out very much money to what you might term people who need it.
Yes, yeah. And in fact, wrote a column that says, it was the headline was something like, just pull your finger out, usually, or something, wasn't it? Which was a sort of different tenor of royal coverage, really. But the other thing that I've noticed, particularly, and I think this is about these new biographies, is that there is now a willingness to criticise the Queen for her role in bringing up Andrew and making him the man that he is, in a way that would have been completely unthinkable directly after her death, when it was very much kind of like, you know, sort of veneration and a long life of service and no criticism whatsoever. So there is a kind of change in that. And I think it's really interesting. I'm just looking, so I'm writing a book at the moment which is set in 1993 at the height of the War of the Waleses. And the difference, even with everything I'm saying about Andrew now, is that the tone of royal reporting then was, I mean, this was the point where we were getting sort of royal phone calls recorded and turning up with, you know, Charles's
Squidgy
mistress
Gate, yes.
and Squidgy, who was a Diana's gentleman friend as well, which is, there was this extraordinary sort of free-for-all in the tabloids for a while then. Then when Princess Diana died, it sort of flipped back in and you had that younger generation and very much a feeling that the intrusion into Harry and William's life was completely unacceptable. And I just think it's sort of slightly starting to swing back in this other direction. I think it's interesting as well, as you always have to look, particularly for us, is who's steering the stories and what's going on there. And of course, you know, there was always, as Flunky chronicled in the pages of Private Eye, a big battle between Prince Charles, as he then was, and his kind of press operation, which was run very, very separately from the Buckingham Palace press operation. And I don't think, I mean, I think there might be some helpful spin doctoring going on in the King, who really does seem to wash his hands entirely of his little brother and just kind of pushing things in the direction of, well, I mean, you did this in the Eye quite recently in, it's not Sylvie Crin anymore, it's Dame Hedda Shoulders.
No, Dame Hedda Shoulders, yes. Much, much younger and more with it, novelist.
But, you know, the point that Charles actually probably has a few resentments from childhood, which are kind of coming out now in a kind of public forum.
Entitled is very good on that, the Andrew Lowney book about the fact that Andrew was the kind of favourite son. His nickname from his mother was Baby Grumpling, which is really, I think that's really cute, but I can see it maybe it turned him into a
baby
monster.
Grumpling's from The Perishers, which was a cartoon strip in the Daily Mirror back in the 60s. I never had her down as a mirror reader.
Oh, she was a lifelong socialist.
she called Phil Andy Cat behind his back.
Poor old Andy. He's been invited to rescind his freedom of the City of London by the Corporation of London recently.
So no more driving a sheep over London Bridge.
Exactly. He's lost that privilege.
What more can they take away from him?
It's the final straw, isn't it? Sheep straw.
Yes, thank you.
Flunky ended up saying that one of the few people who'd spotted that Mandelson was up to no good was the King.
Mm.
I thought that must have been unhappy reading for Keir. you're less in touch with what's going on than the King.
Well, he specifically said that Mandelson and the King were quite good mates at one point in the sort of 90s, but even His Majesty spotted that after the first resignation, maybe this was a slightly dubious person to be hanging around with, and the second kind of definitely made that concrete for him. But there you go. Once again, developed vetting. Should have had a word. Yep. There we go. All right. What we haven't got is buzzers here. So I'm going to give you each a sound so you can jump in. Helen, I would like you to give, when you know the answer, a herald's trumpet. Perfect.
Thank you.
Good.
Saba, can we have a loyal hooray from you?
Hooray.
No, come on. A bit more than that. Oh, yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, that's okay. Brilliant.
It's a bit more manly.
Yeah. Ian, if your buzzer sound can be a fervent God bless you, Mom.
Yes. Right. Delivered in the cheeky accent urchin. Of... What, Dick Van Dyke?
Full Pearly King, I want that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. So, question one. Come in when you know the answer with your appropriate noise. The Queen spoke the first ever photo bubble on a Private Eye cover in issue 5. Or at least the speech bubble was coming out of the Royal State Coach, so we're assuming it was her. What was the occasion?
God bless you, Mom.
Go on, then.
It was the birth of Prince Charles, and she was on the way to the hospital.
You're a few years too late. Birth of Prince Edward comes not shortly afterwards, but Charles has been around. Charles is actually 13, but I'm going to give you half a point because he was in hospital. He was having an emergency appendectomy, and the speech bubble coming out of the Royal Coach was saying, "Great Ormond Street, James, and step on it." But yes, yeah, the coverage of Prince Edward's birth a bit later on in 1963, and Princess Anne starting at Benenden as well. Just gives you an idea of how long Private Eye has been going. We were covering the royal children who are now grandparents. It's extraordinary. Number two, one of the earliest bits of journalism in the Eye, because the jokes came first in Private Eye, the journalism sort of joined a few years later in the 1960s. One of the first bits of journalism that appeared, however, was in November 1964, and it wasn't the Eye's own journalism. Instead, it was a roundup of what the French and German papers were saying about what particular royal scandal uncovered in the British media.
Which year again?
1964.
God bless your mom.
Go on, sir.
Was it Profumo?
No, this is post-Profumo. It's a little bit vague. Yeah,
was it one involving ships? Quite often they'd involve ships or helicopters.
No, not this one particularly. There was a lot of stuff about Prince Philip flying helicopters and how safe he was. Yeah, yeah.
No, not that.
Never that safe behind the wheel of a car either. Saba, do you want to come in with a wild guess?
Shall I just do the...
Prince Philip.
Hooray!
Yeah, that was quite frightening,
I just
actually.
To do it. I haven't got an answer.
It was the way you did eye contact to me when I did that. It was quite frightening.
Was it something to do with one of the royals going out with someone who wasn't quite up to scratch?
You could definitely get half a
point. Oh, it was Margaret, was it?
No, it was Philip.
Philip.
It was implications that he was... well, let me give you the translations that were provided from the French papers. La Reine Elisabeth is spending nights alone while Prince Philip sips champagne with girls from a ballet troupe in Mexico. He was, to be fair, on a royal trip to Mexico by himself at that point. It wasn't that he just kind of laid down an argument. He stormed out and gone all the way to Mexico. It was a solo 9-day tour. But according to the French press, as reported at this point in Private Eye in 1964, Elizabeth was toujours triste, toujours seule, always alone, always sad. She cannot go on. She has decided to support no more of it in future. She's on the edge of a nervous breakdown, on the brink of the abyss. She is no longer our proud and haughty queen. She did manage to carry on for
50 years.
Several decades after that. And
French
apparently
press have always been good on the royals.
Well, it's a bit like, do you remember the National Enquirer for ages, for about 10 years, just kept running a headline that just said, Queen Elizabeth at death's door, which is one of those headlines that eventually was going to be true and eventually was, of course, in 2022. Can I just give you the last tiny, beautiful detail from this? Apparently, according to the French press, the Queen was haunted by plaintive inquiries of her little Prince Andrew, naively asking, tell me, Mama, is it Mexico that Papa is?
What?
So there you go.
Like Yoda.
I think it lost something in translation.
There is something
actually
about royal reporting that encourages total nonsense.
Yes, make it up. They're not going to deny it. Number three, the big one. Who named the Queen Brenda?
I'm going to go Willie Rushton because he feels like he did a lot of naming.
Not Willie Rushton, no.
Was it Prince Philip?
God bless you, sir.
God bless you, sir.
Sorry. No, it wasn't. And it wasn't Private Eye, even though we've adopted the nickname and have been using it ever since. According to the Grovel column, which was kind of sort of weird society column that Private Eye ran in the 70s, 1971, it reported that it was a nickname used by her immediate staff. So actually a genuine nickname within the palace, which was then adopted by Private Eye. A few years later, they added a couple of others. The obvious one, Prince Charles.
Brian.
King, yep, now known as Brian, still known as Brian, still confusing people online whenever anyone puts any of our stories up online. Who is Brian? What is this?
He's the king.
We also had Princess Margaret. Anyone want to guess what she was known as?
Yvonne.
Oh, very, very good. You have been reading past issues.
I have.
And can you remember what the nickname courtiers gave to Diana when she joined the royal family in 1981 was?
Believe it to be Cheryl, or is it Cheryl?
You've
Cheryl.
Been cheating. You knew this quiz was coming up.
I just did a little like...
She's just a royalist.
All right, you're not going to get this one. Okay. In 2018, Flunky revealed that the nickname for Harry and Meghan within the royal household. Can you remember that one?
I'm just going through famous twosomes. I'm like, I've got stuck on like... Bennifer.
No.
Was it Posh and Becks?
No, that would be quite a good one as well.
Kinky and Perky?
Chandler and Monica. On the grounds that he was a bit weird and married someone much hotter than him with very, very firm ideas.
That's not bad.
Mm. Yeah. I think it lost out because H&M works as well. You know, they're sort of nice high street clothes.
H-bomb.
That's
sorry
the,
to give you flashbacks.
The, Charlotte Griffiths has come back into the room. A reprise of last
time's
drama.
I'm afraid listeners of the podcast were rather confused because it was so realistic. the rendering of the transcript. They thought we'd hired Prince Harry and Charlotte Griffiths to come and do this podcast.
Sadly, we can afford Prince Harry, but we can't afford Charlotte Griffiths. She charges far too much. Okay, in March 2016, when Michael Gove was forced to deny being the source of a claim that ended up on the front page of The Sun as the headline, Queen Backs Brexit, the eye ran a cover of Her Majesty at the state opening parliament, facing a row of officials, including Michael Gove, the speech bubble from off the page saying, "Just point to the person who did it, Your Majesty." What special news did we receive via Palace back channels after that cover came out?
Presume she loved it. She had it put in her little box that she used to get and watch Neighbours and read.
She absolutely did, yes. Yeah. This message in full which came through to us. The front cover of the current eye was included in the cuttings sent up to the Queen most days and didn't return, which usually means that it made it into her personal scrapbook. She collects cartoons and send-ups, even the unkind ones, if she finds them funny. So there you go. You've got a fan, Ian.
Well, just like George III.
Did he have a personal scrapbook of private eye covers?
He did. It was some of our first issues.
Our best woodcuts were in there.
He bought a lot of cartoons of himself and his son. He did, yes. He had a very, very good collection.
He rather liked being called Farmer George, didn't he? He liked it as a nickname, yes.
He did, because he was not unlike the present king in that he was very interested in agriculture when everyone else thought it was boring.
I like the idea of the Queen being some kind of super editor of private eye. She's got her own versions in her scrapbook.
Yeah, with only the good ones.
All about her. Not much about Andrew, though.
Probably lots about Andrew and hardly anything about Charles, I should think, actually. Well, this is what we'll find out from the official biography, presumably. Someone will be allowed to look in that scrapbook and confirm that this is true.
But the Brexit story has appeared in The Hardman, hasn't it?
Yeah, and is also being countermanded now. The Spectator ran a piece saying she was... Spectator, edited by Michael Gove, ran a piece saying she was actually extremely anti-Brexit and pro-Europe. So,
well, she was anti-Scottish referendum. If you remember, David Cameron said she purred down the phone to him when she found out the union had held together. So, but I remember when I used to do a podcast with Stephen Bush now at the FT, he pointed out that demographically she was a white pensioner without a college degree. That says Brexit.
Yeah, a lot of relatives from the continent though, so she had some European
ties. Yeah, but a lot of people in Spain as expats voted for Brexit, that's so true. The fact that Philip was Greek...
But then she wore the blue and yellow outfit.
Yeah, for Ukraine, there was that. Oh, yeah. No, that was the one with the...
With the stars.
The flowers that look like stars.
Which I think is definitive.
Right, case closed. Will there be more, Adam?
There is one more question, which I suspect Ian might get ahead of the other two of you.
Rigged.
We'll go with it. In the same year, an even better cover in July of new Prime Minister Theresa May doing the most extraordinarily low curtsy, almost all the way down to the floor, as the Queen said to her, "How low can you go?" And Theresa May replied, "I've appointed Boris Johnson as Foreign Secretary." Whose joke was that, Ian? Who wrote that one? Ian, whose joke was it really?
Sheila's.
Yes. Was this the one occasion where the managing director of Private Eye has given this as the joke for the cover?
Yes, and it was very annoying because it was incredibly funny.
It's a great joke. And
Sheila was essentially the managing director of Private Eye for about 300 years since George III, and her job was to try and keep this thing afloat, not to provide better jokes than me.
Well, her involvement on covers usually was to come down and see what you're putting on Monday and go, "Oh, not the Prime Minister again, that's 10,000 sales we've lost." But not on this occasion.
No, she hit the jackpot.
Right, brilliant. Well, as a result of that, I can reveal that Helen... gets the regal nod of approval, the sword on both shoulders, and whatever medal you would like to take home with you. Yeah,
I don't think I've ever won a private eye quiz before. This is very exciting to me.
I know, we just felt sorry for you. Ian got far more questions right than you. But it's just traditional, he always loses on the telly.
Finally, the rigging works in my favour. Well, that is it for this episode of Page 94. We'll be back in a fortnight with another one, possibly involving Andy. Until then, thank you to Saba, Adam and Ian. And thank you to you for listening. If you'd like to get more joke stories, pictures of the Queen, actually probably not pictures of the Queen anymore, maybe a small amount, then please subscribe to Private Eye by going to private-eye.co.uk. If you'd like to subscribe, that'd be great. If you'd like to buy the newsagents, also great. The only remaining thanks go to Matt Hill at Rethink Audio for producing. See you.